Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Richard Halpern, author of Leibnizing, A Philosopher in Motion. Published by Columbia University Press, it was released a couple of months ago. Richard is the Eric Maria Remarque Professor of Literature Emeritus at NYU. His previous works include Eclipse of Action, The Poetics of Primitive Accumulation, Shakespeare Among the Modern, and works as disparate as Norman Rockwell and, well, Leibniz. So, me and Leibniz. Well, for good or bad, my introduction to him was through the auspices of his nemesis, if you will, Voltaire. And Candide, still one of the funniest books I've ever read, along with Humphrey Clinker. So Professor Pangloss, whose motto was that all is the best for the best in this best of all possible worlds. And my first thought as a 12-year-old was, what an idiot. And reading that book was enlightening as, aside, All Quiet on the Western Front. And once in a while, it almost made sense to me that if there was a volcano in Lisbon, there wasn't one where I was sitting. So, okay. And then I found out about monads, which still are a kind of gnomon for the course of my life. I mean, not only are they the most fundamental of all particles units, but along with Leibniz's theories on space and time, he presages Einstein, as the great man acknowledges, and even Max Planck. So where is Leibniz now in our digital AI-driven generative universe, you know, where I have a thumb drive with everything from monads to my estate plan? And which thumb drive I lost yesterday and just found, and I'm still having heart palpitations. But I digress, as dear listener, you've put up with for over a decade. So with that, welcome, Richard, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So many questions, but I guess to set the stage, and it always goes to the title for me, why did you turn a man's name into a verb, kind of like web surfing?
Right. Okay. So for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to take a different approach to Leibniz from the one that is generally taken in philosophical studies. And those studies focus on Leibniz as a philosophical system builder. But systems are static. And I think that a better approach to Leibniz, or at least another approach to Leibniz, is through the movement of his writing, the sentences as they unfold one after another. And because I'm a literary critic, maybe that's kind of a natural approach. So I turned him into a verb in part in order to focus on that, like Leibnizing, not the results of his thinking after it's done, but the process of it as it's going on. So that's one reason that I use the phrase Leibnizing. The other is that Leibnizing is something that not only Leibniz does. I think he establishes a very distinctive style of philosophical thinking, but then other people take it up. And one of the other things my book looks at is later thinkers in the 20th and 21st centuries who take up Leibniz's style of thinking. So Leibnizing goes on even after Leibniz himself is gone.
Well, then you go to the subtitle, which is A Philosopher in Motion.
Yeah.
And then, so I'm thinking, okay, the flow of Leibniz.
Yes.
There's the still in motion, which goes to your first question in the book, which is why read him? Or actually maybe even why read him instead of extolling Spinoza?
Spinoza. So yes, so for philosophers, Leibniz is every bit as important a figure as Spinoza. Philosophers actually come up with lists of the greatest philosophers, and they do it in all, at least in semi-seriousness. And Leibniz is always ranked as highly as Spinoza. But among my people, my tribe, literary critics, also political philosophers, and people who are associated with theory, as it's sometimes called, literary theory, French theory, Leibniz is very much in Spinoza's shadow, and that's for various reasons, partly because Spinoza was an important political philosopher and Leibniz wasn't, but also I think there are complicated reasons for that. And so Leibniz, I think, has been unduly ignored by people who are interested in art and literature and other fields, who should be paying more attention to him than they are currently. And so I'm making a case for him, say, hey, yes, Spinoza's amazing, definitely read Spinoza, definitely spend a lot of time thinking about him, but there's also this other really interesting guy whom you can learn a lot from.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, whether you go to Wikipedia or any critique of Leibniz, one of the first sentences is going to say he's a polymath. And like we were talking about before we started, you know, you don't take a course in college polymath 101.
That's true. And but college kind of tries to make you into a polymath because they have distribution requirements, right? Like, so if you want to be an engineer, they want you to take an English course or a history course. I mean, they want you to know about different kinds of things. And Leibniz kind of took that to an extreme. He's often, a phrase often applied to him is the last universal genius. And so he had accomplishments in a lot of fields. I mean, I talk about him mostly as a philosopher, but he was a really important figure in the history of mathematics. I mean, he co-invented calculus, which is, you know, pretty important to the modern world. He anticipated a lot of developments in computer science and even artificial intelligence. He was an important historian. I mean, this is the thing about him. He didn't just know about a lot of different areas. He made significant contributions to them. He was a legal theorist. He was a theologian. He had things to say about biology and physics and chemistry, geology. You know, this was at an earlier time. It's in the middle of the 17th century, where it was still possible for someone to know just about everything that was known. That's not possible anymore. So Leibniz was the last universal genius, in part because he had an incredibly capacious mind, and in part because he lived at a moment when it was still possible to get a kind of, you know, overview of everything that was going on.
Yeah, I certainly didn't expect, you know, and the book is great because you learn so much about a man that you probably didn't know that much about first. I didn't expect diagrams of, you know, mathematical diagrams.
And, oh yeah, I mean, he was a really important mathematician. It wasn't just calculus. I mean, he made important contributions to geometry and other fields. But the thing that's most, I mean, if you learn, there was a kind of a rivalry between him and Newton on this. Newton also invented calculus, and Leibniz independently invented calculus, but Newton didn't think that he did it independently. Newton thought that he plagiarized it from him. And in fact, Leibniz had seen one paper that Newton wrote, but historians of mathematicians have determined that he did it independently on his own. But Newton and his followers openly accused Leibniz of plagiarizing the invention from Newton.
When you talk about like some of the things he did that ended up being part of computer science, didn't he kind of invent some kind of initial calculator that was essentially a computer?
A very primitive, yes. So he invented a mathematical calculating machine, and it could add and subtract and multiply and divide numbers, except it actually couldn't multiply and divide. That part of it he never quite perfected. It could add and subtract. And he spent decades fussing with this thing, trying to get it to actually work. But yeah, that was important. So he invented what you could consider a kind of primitive computer hardware, but he also invented a kind of primitive computer software, which was even more important. He had this dream of what he called a general characteristic. And it was a system for sort of automatically producing knowledge. And he would take concepts and break them down into their component parts. He would assign numbers to those parts, and through a certain set of arithmetical operations, you could purportedly produce truths out of this, like new knowledge out of this system. Like the calculator, it never really worked. he didn't, you know, in the middle of the 17th century, he didn't have the wherewithal to do that. But the idea of it was really important for computer science and all of the, you know, not only present day computer scientists and researchers in artificial intelligence, but all the historical figures, the logicians and so forth, who led to the development of computers, all of them considered Leibniz to be a really important founding figure. And he's very much revered by them.
Yeah, it's one of the words you use that I thought, wow, I can't believe he's using the term generative. And then, of course, I thought of ChatGPT.
Right.
And then I thought, okay, let me figure this out. So generative, he's got all this stuff coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's more stuff coming out because right. He has all this stuff
yes.
ready to go.
Yes, that's true. Yes, he's as prolific as ChatGPT. He produced about 200,000 manuscript pages over the course of his lifetime. So yeah, not only was there a lot of input in the sense that he was reading everything that was, you know, written at the time, but he was, you know, producing a lot of output. Now, he's not, you know, so I guess you could... I don't know if you could use the word scraping that tends to be used with chat, you know, ChatGPT. I guess Leibniz did a very advanced form of scraping. And of course, there are people who argue that what ChatGPT does, which is just predict the next word in a sequence, is actually not unlike what we do when we are thinking and speaking, even though it doesn't seem that way to us. So I suppose, I mean, depending on how close you think ChatGPT is to actual human thought, I guess he's that close or not close to Leibniz.
The funny thing is the critics of ChatGPT, they always say, well, it gets this wrong and it gets this wrong. And yeah. I think it's based out of fear because human beings get pretty much everything wrong.
That's true. Yes, that's true. And Leibniz got a lot wrong as well. So he has that. And in fact, along with that, I just read something this morning about a threat to these kind of programs called model collapse, which is that, you know, at the moment, ChatGPT takes, you know, they take published books and internet musings and so forth and feed tons of it into it, all of which are by human beings, which is very helpful. As these AI systems themselves produce more and more text, and you're training new ones, they're going to be learning more and more from stuff that was churned out by other AI systems. And so there's the threat of what's called model collapse. They'll just start, the errors will be recycled. I mean, aside from the errors that humans produce, there's a whole different level of error that produces when AI systems start absorbing the results of other AI systems.
Yeah, it's like a nervous breakdown or feedback.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, it's funny because if you bring in the theological aspect of this, and you posit that, that's not the right word, but foundationally, Leibniz believed in a God and a benevolent God who could have created any universe he wanted to create.
Yes, yes.
Which almost goes to like the multi-worlds concept today.
Oh yeah, absolutely does. Yes, people who work in multiverse theory often refer to Leibniz actually.
Really?
And he has an image at the end. He has a long work called Essays on Theodicy. And there's a kind of allegory at the end of it. And God has created a kind of giant pyramid in which worlds are stacked upon worlds and they're coming up, and then there's the top one, there's the most perfect of all of those worlds, and that's the one that God chooses to create and make into the actual world.
Whereas Voltaire's gone, okay,
yeah,
God wound this up,
things
and then
could be better, things could
look at this, I'm taking right. off and going on vacation,
right? I mean, yeah, and Voltaire made fun of Leibniz for that, and you know, there was a turn against him that his most notorious phrase was that this is the best of all possible worlds. And the argument behind it is not that controversial. Look, assuming that you believe in God, which he did, and most people of his day did, the argument was very simple. If God is infinitely good, then he would create the best world he possibly could, right? I mean, if he created one that wasn't as good as it could be, that would mean that he wasn't as good as he could be. Or the other alternative was that he wanted to create the best possible world, but wasn't able to do it, in which case you believe that God is not omnipotent. He doesn't have infinite power. So Leibniz says, well, if God is infinitely good and he has the power to accomplish everything he wants to do, then this is the best world that could possibly be created. God considered all the possibilities and he chose the best one. The problem is that when you look at the actual world and aren't working the question through logically, this doesn't always look like the best of all possible worlds. Or another way to put it, and I think we should take this seriously, is that the notion that this is the best of all possible worlds isn't necessarily a comforting idea if you take it seriously. Like, so, okay, you take into account all the horrible things that happen, and then you say, well, this is the best it could be. All the other possibilities are worse still, okay? It suddenly starts looking not like an optimistic doctrine, but like potentially a pretty pessimistic one. And that's something I find interesting in Leibniz. They're kind of dark. He does have kind of a sunny disposition, I would say, in general, but there are definitely veins of darkness running through it. And I think those are even visible in when he's talking about the notion that this is the best of all possible worlds.
That brings up something for me, because I've read a little bit about it. When you said he has a sunny disposition, we should talk a little bit about his personal life, you know, because he never married, but he seemed like a nice man. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So we have there is no indication that Leibniz either married or had any kind of romantic entanglements or romantic interests at all, which is a potentially interesting topic, but I found no one writing or thinking about it. He was profoundly devoted to his intellectual undertakings, but he was also profoundly dedicated to his own self-advancement in the world. He wanted to be considered an important intellectual. He wanted to be patronized by important, you know, nobles. He didn't want to spend his time in the intellectual backwater of Hanover, where he lived. He wanted to spend time in Paris and London and other more interesting and exciting cities. He was a courtier. You know, he had to, Bertrand Russell described him as being addicted to the smiles of princes. And so, and that affects his work. He's very careful not to upset people or to say things that he thinks might prove too controversial. So, you know, so that sort of affects the tenor of his work.
Mentioning Bertrand Russell, towards the end of the book, you have a segment, and you know, the book, you know, that's the other thing, the book is really funny, and I don't think people would go into it thinking it's going to be funny. Well, and I can see you smiling the entire time you're talking about it. But talk about that, the latte incident. Was that Bertrand Russell or was it Alfred? Who was that?
No, that's latte. No, that's Leibniz himself.
Okay.
He said to a friend of his that there's no reason to think that monads that are waiting to be born couldn't be floating around in the cafe latte that I'm drinking right now. I took that, I kind of took that up and played with it and imagined Leibniz as a monad kind of floating up into the head of that Alfred North Whitehead might drink him in a cup of tea and have Leibniz floating up in his brain, because Whitehead was one of the people that Leibniz influenced later on.
And that leads into monads, which is one of the things I really wanted to get into, because like I said, it's been important in my life, you know, and you're interested in the Greeks, you know, when you read the bio. Yeah. And you think back to the Greeks and the concept of the atom, but it's not the atom.
No.
But it makes my head hurt thinking about why it's not the atom.
Okay, so I can easily distinguish it from an atom, because an atom is the smallest unit of the physical world for the Greeks, right? All physical things were made up of atoms. But monads are not physical. They're not part of the physical world. They're mental entities for Leibniz. And so Leibniz accepted Descartes' division of everything that exists into extended things, things that take up space, those are physical things, and thinking things that are minds. So monads are minds, basically. That's the easiest way to put it. And Leibniz was aware that human beings had minds, that animals had minds, and sometimes he seems to think that even what we would consider inanimate objects have minds. And this is a philosophical position called panpsychism, that everything in the world has a mind associated with it. And you might think of that as a kind of historical relic, but oddly to my thinking, it's pretty widely entertained among certain philosophers of mind, even today, and really highly respected ones, people like David Chalmers and Galen Strawson and so forth. They confront a problem that I think Leibniz set for them, which is the apparent incompatibility of bodies and minds. That there's the problem of how does something that's aware of itself arise from the hardware that is the brain? And for a certain class of philosopher of mind, this is essentially an insoluble problem. There's no way it can happen. Thought can't arise from matter. And so they take the view, well, if that's the case, then matter has to already think. Now, I think that point of view is kind of ridiculous. And there's no scientific evidence to suggest that matter thinks. And a lot of panpsychists think that even like protons and electrons, subatomic particles, have very primitive forms of mind. But you could argue that Leibniz is at the origin of that as well. Every physical thing in the world has a mind associated with it. It's not exactly in it, but it's associated with it.
Well, it's like when I interviewed David Chalmers and I asked him the question I ask everybody, and Leibniz kind of reminds me of this. I said to David Chalmers, what if this is just a solipsistic universe and one of us is here, the other one isn't?
Mm-hmm.
It always gets them kind of upset because it ruins their theories.
Okay.
Of course, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, you're expressing Cartesian skepticism, right? Like you can only know that you think, you know, if the cogito, I think, you can know that I think, but you can't know that other people think.
You can't disprove it. That's the problem.
You can't disprove it. Yeah, it could all be a dream. It could be inspired by a demon. Everybody else could be a zombie or a robot that's just convincing you. And of course, in the age of Chat GPT, robots are getting much better at convincing us that they are real. In fact, there's that famous case. There was that Google employee who was terminated because he decided that their artificial intelligence model was sentient and wouldn't shut up about it, and they eventually let him go.
Well, like, you know, these guys are way past the Turing. I mean, ChatGPT and all the other ones are way past the Turing test. I can talk.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, they certainly pass it. I mean, they can convince you. If you don't know that you're talking to ChatGPT, you'd think you were talking to a person, and that is the Turing test, right? I mean, if you can have a conversation with a program and not know that it's a program, it's past the Turing test, and they definitely do that. At least most.
Well, let's go back to self-awareness then, because you touch upon, and it's always like blurry to me, but you touch upon this idea of essentially, I'm looking out the window at trees, but I'm not really looking out the window at trees. I'm looking at the window at something that I've interpreted as a tree.
Yeah.
And it gets really difficult to work with.
And, yeah.
But he thought, did he feel that way?
Yeah, so that's the other thing. So monads are minds, but they're minds that are pre-programmed with all of their perceptions. So if for Leibniz, if you look out the window and see a tree, it's not because you're actually perceiving a window or perceiving a tree. It's because the perception of a window and a tree was pre-programmed into your brain from the start. And that's another way in which he is kind of anticipatory of computer models. I mean, he really thinks that the mind is a kind of algorithm that runs and generates term after term. We don't take, and you know, he he took seriously Descartes' dualism. And so he said, well, if you really, Descartes kind of cheated at the end. He said, okay, minds are of a different nature than bodies, but there are ways for them to interact. There are ways for the physical world to kind of pass into the brain, through the pineal gland, actually, in the brain. Leibniz would not have that. He says they're of essentially separate natures, and so they can have nothing to do with one another. And so you kind of have an explanation of seeing, with which is where light is passing into the eye and into the retina, and, you know, passes into the nerves and into the brain. And that's great, but for Leibniz, that's all happening in the physical world. There's no way for what happens in your eye or your brain or your body or the outside world to have any influence on mental entities. And so the only alternative that remained for him was to think that knowledge is everything you know and think is kind of pre-programmed into you. He wasn't the first person to come up. I mean, Plato also felt exactly the same way. He said learning was what he called anamnesis, which is an unforgetting of things. Like you always already knew kind of what's, you know, what you knew, and you just kind of learning is a process of unforgetting what was already programmed in there. So,
and that seems to like say kind of Voltaire was right, because where is God in all of these details, if you will?
Oh, because God is the programmer. God programs everybody's sequence of perceptions and programs them such that my perceptions will agree with yours. If we're in the same room, we'll see the same things. So for Leibniz, and this is where it gets kind of crazy and complicated, it's all a really complicated dance that God has programmed this immense mechanism comprised of infinities upon infinities of monads, and they're all mutually accommodated to each other, and they all see things that sort of agree with one another. And so this is what Leibniz calls pre-established harmony. And God has made the world to be as harmonious as it can possibly be.
That kind of ties into, you know, what Einstein acknowledged, that, you know, the space-time continuum thing as well.
Yeah. Which,
wow, I can't believe that he, you know, that he kind of started that.
Yes, Leibniz, so Leibniz, for Leibniz, monads are the only truly real things in the world. And he goes back and forth on the question of whether bodies are real or whether they're just phenomenal things that we see. But monads are really real. And so Leibniz came to the view that time and space themselves were not real. They're just measures of relationships between things. There is no absolute space. There is no absolute time. There are just relative positions in space and relative positions in time. This was one of his fights with Sir Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton thought that space and time were absolute. And in this case, although Newton was a much greater physicist than Leibniz could ever hope to be, Leibniz turned out to be correct that Einstein's theory of special relativity in many ways vindicated Leibniz's view that, you know, spatial and temporal position are merely relative to certain observers and certain observational frames.
It's amazing because it makes you think of not only Einstein on one side, but then you think of Max Planck on the other side, because you can think of monads as quanta, like a discrete. And then that's like Einstein saying God doesn't play dice with the universe, and you're saying he does.
For Leibniz, no. The universe is entirely pre-programmed. There is no chance for Leibniz. Everything that happens is completely determined for Leibniz. But if you want to get to connections between Leibniz and contemporary quantum theory, for Leibniz, the physical worlds and the mental worlds, as he puts it, express one another. And for Leibniz, the physical positions of bodies in space are an expression of the relations, this is going to get a little complicated, of the monads that are associated with the mental entities and how they perceive one another. So space and time are basically expressions of relations among mental entities, which themselves are not spatial or temporal. Okay, so to get back to quantum theory, there's some speculation among quantum theorists that space and time are created by the entanglement of particles, that the quantum entanglement actually of a kind that isn't actually spatial or temporal ends up producing space or time. So there's a kind of, this is a little vague, but there's a kind of charming analogy between Leibniz's notion that the relations among monads produce space and time, and this rather recent notion that entanglements among bulk entanglements among quantum particles might produce space and time.
That's like spooky action at a distance.
Yes, it is. No, absolutely. Yes, that is. And so it's not only at a distance, but this takes it a step further and says that spooky action creates distance. It actually creates space and time. That's why it can seem to move across space and time, because space and time are actually a product of these interactions among particles.
Here's a question. If all this hurts my brain, does it ever hurt your brain?
In a good way. It's a kind of pleasurable pain. Yeah, I mean, reading Leibniz was a challenge for me sometimes at first, though also immensely pleasurable. I happen also to have a kind of layman's interest in science. I started out as a physics major, or would-be physics major, before I became a literature major. So I've carried a little bit of that with me, and I suppose that seeps into the book as well. I don't know why. I think humanists' heads tend to hurt a lot when they think about science and mathematics too hard, you know, but I like the pain that it produces.
It drives some insane, some philosophers
yes,
insane.
Yes, this is true.
But, you know, I was thinking, in the sense that Einstein was spiritual, which he was, you know, you again, you know, bring, and the reason why you should continue to read Leibniz is like, you take the Big Bang, then he's positing a kind of singularity, that God is kind of a singularity.
Yes, that seems like I like that way of putting it. Yes, and just as the Big Bang is kind of the start of time, right? It doesn't happen in time. There's no moment when the Big Bang occurs. It generates time as well as space. So the God's creation of the world, in a sense, happens before, you know, it's time. Time is a product of God's creation of the world, not something that the creation happens in.
Yeah, but then that means the singularity could be just one monad too.
Yeah, it could. I mean, Leibniz doesn't tend to think of God. He doesn't think of God as a monad, because a monad is for him a created thing. It's a thing that's pre-programmed, and so who pre-programmed God? That leads to a kind of infinite regress. So he doesn't think of it that way. But
what gives him the right to think of God as an absolute then? He seems too smart.
The right as an absolute. Well, I think it was not an unusual. That was not an unusual point of view at his time. I mean, it's funny, we think of, to go back to the Leibniz-Spinoza dichotomy, Spinoza was often accused of being an atheist, right? And he was actually excommunicated from the Jewish community in Amsterdam because his thinking was so heterodox. Leibniz is often thought of as being, by contrast, kind of pious and, you know, sort of ordinary in his thinking about God. But that's wrong. He was also accused of atheism. His views were often accused of being dangerous. He was nicknamed Glaubenichts, or the one who doesn't believe in anything, in his hometown in Germany, because he wouldn't go to church very often. So it's as with his optimism, supposed optimism, I think there's a fair amount of pessimism in it. As with his piety, I think there's a kind of dangerousness to his thought that people often kind of overlook.
Well, not to belabor the point, but isn't some of this tautological? Because if it's totally pre-programmed, everything he himself did,
yes,
there was no choice.
You would have no problem. I mean, well, you could say, but is that a tautology? So it would just be an admission that I'm not different from the other, that my formulation of this philosophy was as pre-programmed. You'd want that, otherwise he would be an exception, and that would contradict his point of view. Now, I should say that Leibniz also believes in human freedom and makes a lot of arguments on behalf of it. My own personal view is that his belief in freedom is completely incompatible with and contradictory to his understanding of what monads are.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of contradiction in Leibniz's thinking, which is why I think he's not as systematic a thinker as he's sometimes taken to be.
What if you take like Marcus Aurelius? So the idea is that, you know, you make these mistakes,
mm-hmm.
you learn from them.
Yeah.
And then it's like a baseball player, like watching a game last night. A baseball player commits an error. If he continues to think about that error as he goes back out on the field, he's going to do it again. But if he's able to put it out of his mind completely, then he performs.
Yeah. Yeah. Leibniz learned a lot from the Roman Stoics, actually, including Marcus Aurelius. He does have things to say on these issues on how we... Well, here's what he says. He says there's no such thing as... You can't be perfectly poised between options when you're choosing something. Because if you were perfectly poised, you'd never make a decision between it. It always has to be slightly weighted towards one thing rather than the other. And so even within a moment of free choice, there's a kind of predisposition that leads you to do one thing or another. And that doesn't seem unreasonable. Like, even if you do think that we're free in some sense, it doesn't mean that we don't have, you know, personalities. And,
but we're pre-programmed to be free.
Leibniz thinks we're pre-programmed in such a way as to create the effect of freedom. Let me put it this way, to create the impression that we're free. And that's good enough in a way. As long as you think you're free, as long as you have moments in which you feel like you have responsibility for your existence and that you're making weighty existential decisions, then your existence will be meaningful for you and you will find it all the more rewarding.
Well, then what about ethical norms? I mean, so you're saying Donald Trump is Donald Trump because not only was he pre-programmed, but he's also doing the best that he can do? Is he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not that he's doing the best that he can do, but whatever he is pre-programmed to be that way. So, yeah, I mean, if you take the notion of the monad seriously, it can interfere with your notion of judging behavior because those people could not. But we have all sorts of ways of thinking about behavior that relieve human responsibility, right? I mean, we don't think the way Leibniz does, but we say, well, people are the products of their upbringing or the products of the culture in which they were raised or of their social class or of this or that. I mean, you know, or of the way human psychology works. So, you know, we don't take an unadulterated ethical view towards things. We admit to certain kinds of determinism that tend to make people the way they are, even though we like to maintain a certain region of freedom within that.
Well, then, okay, here's a good question. Well, I think it's a good question.
Okay,
if you step outside your book, yeah, you wrote this book, here it is, it's self-contained, although it isn't self-contained, because the reason as a bookseller, my customers and myself, when you're done with this book, you're not really done with it, because all kinds of things you can work on afterwards. So actually, that's the question. If you step outside this book, do you agree with him? Do you agree with all this?
Do I agree with him? I don't, I, well, okay. That's a complicated question. So let me give you let me take one of Leibniz's most counterintuitive notions, that we're not actually perceiving the external world, right? Like the mind is a closed system. All right. So in the book, I look at, among other later thinkers, two Chilean neuroanatomists, Humberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, who make an interesting argument. They invent a theory called autopoiesis, and they argue that the nervous system is a closed system, the only thing our nervous system can detect are relative states of excitation among neurons in the system, that the outer world cannot enter into and inform what we're perceiving. And they come up with a very complicated explanation and epistemology to, but that's kind of a Leibnizian approach. And more recently, I read an interesting book by a neuroscientist named Anil Seth called Being You, which also argues that what we see, what we perceive, is not the external world, but our predictions about what the external world will be, that they're actually generated by our brain, and that insofar as the external world enters in at all, it's only as a kind of correction to our predictions. So there's an example. So do I think Leibniz is right? I think that in thinking what he thinks, he's thinking something very counterintuitive, and there are later thinkers who kind of take up elements of that in a suggestive way and suggest that there might be elements of truth to it. Maybe not in the extreme way that Leibniz expressed it, but maybe there's a kind of intuition there that's worth exploring. So that's my answer. Do I think he's right? No, I don't think he's right in any simple sense. Yes, they're monads. Yes, they've all been pre-programmed by God. You know, yes, they're doing. But there are a lot of elements to his thinking that turn out to have been sort of vindicated in the same way that he thought that space and time were the result, you know, merely relative. Yeah, like Einstein kind of, you know, so there are definitely a lot of elements in his thinking that were vindicated, if not in their exactly identical form, then in something quite similar by later thinkers. So in that sense, yeah, I think there's a good deal of truth embedded in Leibniz's thinking.
Whenever I interview someone like you or David Chalmers or other philosophers or neuroscientists or physicists, I always have this set point question. And the question is, why isn't one a prime number? And because it's divisible by itself and one. And 100 years ago, it was considered a prime number. And it always, like, it's a difficult question for people. But then I asked this one guy, Frank Wilczek, who's a Nobel laureate and discovered time crystals, which have just been experimentally validated. And I said to him, so why isn't one a prime number? And he goes, because it wouldn't be convenient.
That's nice.
So
excellent. That's a real mathematician's answer.
Yeah, but do you see what I mean? It's like, it's malleable. And that's why I was asking you outside of the book. I mean.
Oh, like Leibniz in everyday life is, or are you asking about sort of, is Leibniz applicable or is Leibniz?
Yeah, because, you know, you're saying, first of all, you're saying, yes, let's read him. Let's separate him from Spinoza and let's decide that he's still relevant. And I think we've established that he is in so many different ways, but okay. So, and this is for the reader.
Okay.
Also, I should add that the book is very accessible.
Right.
If he's still relevant, and this is good as we close out here, if he's still relevant, what am I supposed to take from that?
Okay. What do I do? Here's what I'll say, and it's something I say early on in the book. It might be useful to think of Leibniz as a science fiction writer of a kind, hard science fiction writer, right? Okay. So science fiction writers are producing fiction, but they're fictions that are related to things that are going on in science, and they're ways of thinking about, you know, kind of issues that might be raised by it. And I think Leibniz is that, you know, we should read Leibniz in exactly that same way. He's a highly imaginative, highly brilliant person, and his thoughts, I think, are generative. And maybe that's the term I want to use. Let's not say, are they right or wrong? are they true or false, but are they generative? Can they foment interesting thinking in us? And that's what I think his use is. And that's why I think we should read him today.
Yeah, it's like reading Neuromancer. Or it's so funny because when I ask all these really intelligent people, they always go back to The Matrix. And I'm thinking, these guys are really smart. Why do they go back to the movie The Matrix? And then a lot of these things are in The Matrix.
Yeah. Well, you know, that moment in The Matrix where reality dissolves into code. Remember, that's very Leibnizian. That's basically, you know, that reality is a kind of projection of this code that's running itself and this algorithm, that's the set of algorithms that are running themselves.
Yeah, it's a great, I think your explanation there is a great way to end this, because I think it gives the reader a really good base for taking off here by the idea that this is science fiction. And it's good that you said hard science fiction. It's not a space opera.
No. Yeah. Leibniz takes science very seriously, but it's a, you know, there's a good deal of fiction embedded in it at the same time.
Thank you so much, Richard, for doing this. We have a science nonfiction book club, and I'm certainly going to look forward to the same arguments that you and I have discussed today.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. So long.
Bye-bye.